Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast, chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and in today's episode, I'm chatting to Scottish filmmakers Gregor Barclay and Colin Bell about their yet-to-be-released debut feature, the post-apocalyptic horror Ribbons, and what is the nearest we have come to an exclusive interview in our short history here at New Horror Express. Over the course of the interview, I chat to them extensively about the making of Ribbons and the difficulties of shooting a feature not only in a mere 4 days, but also completely improvised. We also talk about some of the other challenges the production faced, such as being hit with the Beast from the East, which was a snowstorm that we got here in Scotland last March. Also, before we get to the interview, there was a bit of a mix-up in the beginning of the recording, which I say myself that I'm going to edit out. I was thinking about editing out, but then I listened to it again, and I thought it was a funny, genuine moment, and it was entertaining to listen to. So I've kept it in, and so I hope you appreciate that. Finally, before we get to the interview, this is a totally independent, free podcast coming to you at you every fortnight. So it would be greatly appreciated for anybody who really enjoys this show to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher. Anyway, now that's out of the way. Here is Gregor and Colin.
To go? Yeah, we'll pretend when you say hello that it's the first time.
Okay. I hit record just before that, but I'll edit that out. That's fine. Hi, Gregor.
Hi, Scott. How you doing?
Good. Hi, Colin.
Hi, Scott. How you doing?
Good. I've got you on the show today to talk about your upcoming film, Ribbons, that should be coming out this year.
Fingers crossed. Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to be finished this year. We will have a finished version this year, but I don't think it's going to be...
In terms of release, it'll be very early 2019. We'll be looking out for the release. Yeah.
Yes.
We're going to try and get it to festivals and stuff, I think, in the beginning half of the year.
Yeah.
So technically, some people somewhere will be able to see it.
You might be the first kind of the forefront of the press junket, actually. You're getting very much on the ground floor. It's good.
Excellent. That's what I like. Getting an exclusive, you know, scooping all those other horror sites like Bloody Disgusting and Dread Central and stuff like that. That's a win for me.
You first, Scott. That's important to us, you know.
So, I hear on the grapevine, or from previous guest Grant McPhee, that it was a very interesting shoot, and you were originally going to shoot the film in March, but were hit by the Beast from the East and all that snow earlier on in 2018.
Yeah, it was interesting. When we had our original shoot dates, there was the worst snowstorm in 100 years. And we manfully tried to reduce a 4 day shoot schedule into three, then two, in a kind of act of madness, and we eventually postponed down to the summer. When we shot in the summer, it was the worst heatwave Glasgow had in 100 years. The
bookies would not have taken those odds on us managing to get both extremities. Unless, I mean, if we do another movie, as I've said this before, if we do another movie, the only way we can top that is if like a volcano erupts or something.
But we finally got it shot anyway, and
we were lucky. The equipment hire companies were generous enough to allow us to have the booking again for later.
And still the cast agreed to
to do it again, and you know, everybody was quite good. And we were concerned we were going to have to recast, or we were going to have to get other, you know, different crew in because of everybody's availability later in the year. And we just got really lucky. We managed to get literally to a man, I think, exactly the same people back. Definitely the cast was exactly the same. So yeah, it was good. I mean, like Arnold Clark didn't charge us for the day of the
vans,
the week hire on the van and things like that. So you know, had that not happened, we would have been scuppered.
And I think just the nature of it was the whole thing we're doing a feature film in 4 days, which is by all accounts
bananas.
Madness. Yeah, and it was carefully planned so that we can maximise that what we can create in those 4 days, and to make sure that the time that we spend is going to make sense, and the story is going to make sense, and the cast get time to explore our characters, and then we just kept
to lop an arm off and then lop another arm off. At one point there was a seriously discussion, we've lost 2 full days because of the snow, can we just do it in 48 hours? And I think that was the point where we were like, thinking maybe we could.
We just locked people in the room for solid 48 hours solid.
Well, this is it. If we had been... The reason we couldn't shoot during the snow was because a lot of people were snowed in. But actually, if we'd started shooting the day before, we would have been snowed in on the set. So we would have had no choice but to just film the movie because people couldn't have got home.
And to eat each other.
I think that was the other thing as well, because it was because the movie was improvised. Well, to a degree it was improvised. There was a kind of, we called it a set list. We knew kind of the beats of the movie and where each scene began and ended, but we let the actors kind of take that, so there was no script. I think had we had a proper script, like a written every line of it down there script, we would not have contemplated doing it in 2 days. But actually, theoretically, because we were all in one location and we had the actors improvising it, we could have done in real time almost.
I think it
would have been really difficult.
Very difficult.
But yes, at some point we decided to just cut our losses and reconvene.
Yeah.
And I think that turned out to be
definitely the best call. And so we went with a much more reasonable 4 days shooting schedule for a feature film. And that's what we're kind of working with just now. And I mean, the 4 days were a really brilliant 4 days, both in terms of the energy that everybody across the kind of production and creative team and the cast brought to it. You know, everyone was... One of the things in terms of the way we've made films in the past is we're very careful to make sure that everyone that's there wants to be there. And it seems like an odd thing to have to say, but I think if you carefully select both actors and creatives and your production kind of staff and
especially if it's low budget as well.
Especially if it's low budget and your
people have to want to
be there and want to kind of be part of it and want to just kind of pull in the same direction. And we were phenomenally lucky to find that everyone was just raring to go. They were there early. They were running through walls for us, sometimes literally. To kind of make sure that was a really good experience for everyone. You know, the sound guy on the last day, you know, turned to us and went, that was more fun than work, and that was a hell of a lot of work. And that's brilliant. That's exactly what we try and have with our shoots. And
I think brevity definitely helped. The fact it wasn't a, you know, 6 week shoot.
Oh, if we did it for 6 weeks, we'd lose our minds.
Yeah, but the fact that it was 4 days meant that, you know, it was still fresh even by the time we were kind of winding up. But yes, I think, I mean, I used to play in bands, and we had lots of people in our band at one point, and I did feel like there would be an issue where some people really were keen and some people weren't, and the people that weren't keen sometimes would be not into it, and their degree of not being into it would be infectious.
Yeah.
So other people would say, "Oh, this guy's not having a good time," and that bad time would bleed into the rest of the musicians. And so this is something I was definitely very conscious of us not wanting to have happen, because if one of your actors starts having a shitty time and everybody else starts, you know, suddenly the wheels fall off and you don't have a movie.
Yeah. You mentioned a few times the 4 days there. What inspired you to do that, to make a film in 4 days that was mainly improvised?
Here's the thing, right? When we had this idea, and we went from sort of conception of the idea through to kind of putting it into production very, very quickly. But when Gregor came to me and went, I thought about this really carefully, and we can do this in 4 days. And he really sold me on it. And we sat and we worked out the set list and worked around 4 days. And there was a point at the end of the shoot, I turned around and went, why was that 4 days? And he said, I just pulled a figure out of my arse. 4 days seemed about right.
I think 4 days. 4 days.
And I genuinely think that you thought the idea of seeing a feature film in 4 days was a fun thing to say.
So you think, you think just literally the fact that it was alliterative?
Yeah,
was my reasoning behind it.
And we sort of structured every.
I mean, I could have said feature film in four fortnights if I wanted to go really that way.
That would have been
great. That would have been an 8 week shoot.
That would have been a much more relaxed experience. But I actually
for £440.
But it was we sort of settled on 4 days, and actually, in terms of the breakdown of what we want to do and what we want to achieve, 4 days did make sense because in terms of the budget that we're putting together, and we wanted to pay everyone. We didn't want to kind of have a film where, and again, going back to people wanting to be there, it's really difficult to go, I want to be there for nothing, and then ask them to do a lot of stuff, and even if we're paying them something, we paid everyone enough that it made sense for them to turn up. You get more out of them, you can push them a little bit harder. And so 4 days actually was perfect for that, because in terms of us breaking down that budget, that kind of, you know, this is how much we can realistically afford to have on set and to create and to give ourselves a certain amount of quality in that time. So kind of, yeah, we stuck with 4 days. Although I still hope that you...
The catalyst for me was a TED Talk that it was either a TED Talk or it was like a South by Southwest. I think he's done both, but that Joe Swanberg did, talking about the year in which he made something like 11 movies.
Yeah,
and he did 11 movies in a year. Each of them were for $5,000, and each of them were all set in basically one location or locations he had access to with actors that he knew. And he shot them all improvised and in 4 days. So for 4 or 5 days, I mean, very, very short periods of time. And he basically posited that there wasn't really any good reason not to do a movie that way. You know, if you have the facility to do it and you've never made a feature before, as we hadn't, this is a really good way to get that first feature done. I think he said, I mean, obviously he started making movies kind of 10 years before we did, but he basically said every movie they would make for buttons, $5,000 or whatever, and they would then sell that, and as long as they made back the $5,000 and maybe a little bit more, he would be able to do another one. And so we thought there's nothing fundamentally stopping us from following that. You know, some of those movies are terrible, but some of those movies are pretty good. So it's worth the gamble. What's the worth if the budget's only £5,000 and it's terrible? What have you lost? You've only lost $5,000. It's worth that risk.
Yeah, I think where technology is at the moment, like filmmakers, there's maybe a fear about how large an endeavor making a feature film is. And it is. I mean, there is, in terms of logistics, in terms of planning, in terms of making sure the creative and narrative aspects all make sense.
But not in terms of the gear.
Not in terms of making the film, not in terms of actually just going out and doing it. Everyone has access to enough stuff for not much money, you know, as long as you've got a really clear idea of what that should look like. There's no reason why you can't make a feature very quickly that's good, you know, and that can convey your ideas. And
whereas 25 years ago, the cameras you had access to would be like your dad's VHS, and you wouldn't be able, Sundance wouldn't accept that, you wouldn't be able to enter that into festivals because it's not above, there's a kind of minimum threshold for quality that you wouldn't have hit with prosumer gear. Whereas now your prosumer gear stuff, you know, you can make a DCP and broadcast it, you know, it can go on telly, it can go in cinema, there's nothing really stopping you. I mean, hell, we could have shot in 4K with the camera that I use for my day job. And I mean, we elected to shoot 1080 just because it was an easier workflow, but there was nothing stopping us shooting 4K, which is, you know, you put that in the IMAX, I guess. it might look rubbish on the IMAX. It would be a little grainy, but you know. Definitely we feel like the tech side of it was actually one of the things that we didn't worry about.
No, we didn't. We really didn't. It was all about kind of making that story work.
Yeah.
You know, and that's...
We didn't think that it not looking like it was shot on, you know, an Arri was gonna fundamentally affect the quality of the story.
Yeah. You know, once you get the story, once you create the characters, you let that... That's what creates the film, and certainly for this film, because of the nature of it. One of the things, obviously, you trade off when you're shooting that quantity of footage in that space of time, is you have to be very quick in figuring out how to make a shot look good. You know, that's... you have to be quite...
You're thinking this to be quite efficient.
Efficient, thank you.
But I think also we basically shot a lot of it like it was a documentary.
Yes.
I mean, we had two cameras running constantly, with a couple of exceptions. It was mostly two cameras running constantly, one on a wider lens and one on a longer lens. And it was, we were shooting it like we were, like a doc for bits of it. Yeah. So there were certain points where we would have a composed idea of what the shot was going to look like. And there were other points where we were like, let's just see where the scene goes. I mean, we had two main rooms in the we should probably say, the movie's set in kind of an underground bunker.
We should probably tell people what the movie's about.
Yeah.
No one's seen it, so we should probably explain what the film's about, rather than just launch into it.
So it's a kind of post-apocalyptic thriller, kind of set in a kind of underground bunker. Is that correct?
Yeah. Do you want to do the pitch?
It's basically a guy who's kind of a doomsday prepper that's converted his basement. He's converted his cellar into a fallout shelter for him and his wife. You're making a face.
It's a tiny fallout shelter. It's a very small...
It's very small, but it is his basement.
It is his basement. Yeah.
And then they're having a dinner party. They've got a couple of friends over. And at that point, just by sheer coincidence, a nuclear bomb happens to fall in the city centre of Glasgow. And the four of them have to go down into this two-man shelter where they spend an indeterminate amount of time. That's a terrible pitch. But that's it. So it's mostly about the four of them being trapped in this basement, and one of them is very difficult.
Yeah, basically the dinner party is that if you went into that film not knowing what it was about, you're sort of looking at this boorish, unreconstructed guy just kind of having a difficult time fitting in with certain more modern aspects of life from the point of view of the other kind of younger characters. It's a dinner party that's becoming slightly awkward, and then we, as Gregor says, the bomb drops, and that awkward dinner party is transferred to the having to spend the rest of their lives with each other potentially. You know,
becomes an awkward becomes end of the
an
world,
awkward end of the world, and in amongst that, this guy doesn't need to worry about not being, you know, woke or a guy that can kind of accept others, because you're in his world now, and his world's a world that he's literally built, and it's all they've got, and he's dictating how he thinks they should live. And that, you know,
we always described him as being like your great granddad's viewpoints in a young man's body.
Yeah.
So very, you know, unreconstructed, like misogynist. We went pretty hard to try and make him a very unpleasant character.
Eventually unpleasant character, in that way that people like that. Yeah. There's a veneer where it's an acceptable veneer. It goes about life. He's not obviously consistently fighting with everyone, but there's beliefs underneath that surface. Mm-hmm. And once we take him down,
when we put him into that pressure cooker, the veneer comes out.
There's no society to stop that.
How did you first come up with that idea, and also why did you decide to make it this your first feature? What was it about this particular bones of a story that made you think this is going to be a first feature?
I think we've always got about a dozen ideas that sort of float around without having a place to be, if that makes sense. You know, we're consistently writing many treatments of things, and sometimes entire scripts. So we've always got a kind of little portfolio of ideas. And when we sort of sat down last year, and sort of said, I think Gregor had come to me, we're going to shoot a feature in four days.
We need something for that.
We looked at our portfolio and we sort of picked out aspects of ideas that we liked and sort of fleshed them out and created this story.
We knew it had to be one location.
Yeah.
We knew it had to be a cast, a very small cast. We knew we had to shoot it on basically gear that we already have. So the story kind of formed out of those restrictions in some way.
It's interesting. See when you sit down at a piece of paper and you're writing something, it's a blank piece of paper with all the possibilities in the world. It's quite a difficult beginning to a writing process. But if you put if you hem that in, if all of a sudden you turn to somebody and say, right, there's this space, you know, you've got a garage with half a car in it and a ticking bomb and whatever, you have to make something like that. You know, it's much easier.
These three guys,
you know what I mean? Then you've got that starting point. So from our point of view, we sort of went, like, what do we have on the table? We've got this little pot of half-formed ideas. We've got this location. We've got this gear. We've got access to these actors, you know. What can we make out of that? And we spent a long time kind of forming that into an idea that we really liked.
We had half a dozen other ideas before it, and every single one of them started off as something that we were drawing within the lines, and almost exclusive, almost to an idea. Those other ones we scribbled over the lines, and it became bigger.
And it's interesting because out of those, we're like, oh,
okay, a couple of things.
We're going to break those as a script. That'll be the next thing, you know. Which is a great thing.
We had to keep
going
back to the drawing board and come up with something that very stringently sits within the pen that we've created for ourselves.
In terms of the actual shoot of the film, I mean, £5,000 is not a lot of money for a movie. I take it you had to be very rigid in terms of how you were. Was there a lot of prep with the cast before the actual 4 days? Or did you just kind of go into it?
We did spend some time with the cast, and we sort of...
We had a day.
We more than a day. Leading up to shooting February, we spent a lot of time developing characters with them, you know, and creating what those characters were and giving them the bones of where those narratives would go for each character. And they all got we all developed the backstories with them to make sure that, you know, they knew the belief systems that character would work within. And we were really careful as well in terms of the guys that we brought in, the cast. They were all actors who created their own work as well. You know, the actors who wrote their own things, who directed their own things, or people that we knew that put in a situation where...
Yeah, literally 50% of the cast have directed stuff.
Yeah, 50% of the cast have directed stuff. You know, the other two guys are writing their own stuff and creating their own stuff as well. So taking that time with other writers, effectively, although they're the cast, to create those characters. And then before we got to the shoot in the summertime, we spent time putting those characters in a room together and seeing how they would interact. We gave them situations that weren't the situations in the film, but were very close to the situations in the film, so we could see how they would bounce off each other and make sure that they had the right reactions to each other.
But still, compare that to a traditional feature, the amount of time that we actually spent doing that was still pretty slick.
It was.
I mean, it was the actors, we had the actors together in a room for only one day just because of the amount of time that we... the amount of budget that we had, that we had, there wasn't a huge amount of money to pay for any extra days. I mean, in an ideal world, we would have had a couple of weeks and we would have bashed through it. But you know, that's it is what it is.
So were the cast all actors? I know that the central character is played by Robert Jack. He starred in a couple of your shorts before, Gregor. But the rest of the cast, were they also actors? You knew, or how did you? How did they come to get the parts?
Yeah, I mean, I knew all of them except for Kirsty, and you worked with Kirsty before.
I'd worked with Kirsty on a short where, unfortunately, I felt very guilty about it. She ended up on the cutting room floor, so I felt like we needed to. We'll let her in this one to apologise.
But the rest of the guys are all what we work with. My day job's in theatre, so a lot of those guys I've come across in the sort of theatre world. And we went to, you know, we obviously went to Robbie. He's a guy that's been in a bunch of stuff with Maidens, you know.
He's like a kind of talismanic figure for us. He's like a good luck charm.
Sam Raimi's car. He's our Sam Raimi's car. So we knew these were all guys that we could rely on to produce excellent performances. And like I say, also deal with that improvisational nature of the script as well. So we're really delighted with the cast.
Really worked really well.
Yeah.
We've wandered into a conversation on the second end of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we did. We did get really lucky with the cast. We were very happy with the cast.
Okay.
Especially given that we only had 4 days and they had to basically put the characters together in real time. I mean, I would say 50% of the movie easily is first takes. And the fact that they were able to deliver something that I think is quite rounded space to really delve deep into what the characters are doing, I think really speaks to how competent they were and how good they were on the set.
And how brilliantly surprised you as well. I mean, there was one point where Robbie unleashed something in his character that was so emotional that we had one of our production staff watching it in the monitor was quite physical. Well, she had to stop.
She had to leave the set.
She burst into tears because she was so upset by his performance, which, you know, that's kind of, from our point of view,
everyone else was thinking, oh no, what a terrible thing, and we were thinking, oh, this is great.
Yeah. and you did have these brilliant surprising performances from the cast.
And I mean, a lot of that is the fact that we aren't telling them explicitly what to do for every second, so they're allowed to take risks and they're allowed to try stuff.
And I think they enjoyed it as well. I mean, I think in terms of creating the character, going into a scene and going, what am I going to do in this scene that's going to make this an interesting journey through this scene? Because obviously we're giving them the set list, we're telling them what the journey needs to be within that sequence. But those guys go into that and adding what they've created into it as well, I think is a really brilliantly challenging thing for an actor to do. He absolutely roasted it. We're delighted with the performances we got from.
How different is it? You've created, you said before, you created the kind of set list of the movie, the kind of backbone of what might happen. How different is the movie, the finished product, from how you know, when you write something down, you might envisage it in a certain way, because it's improvised and because there's all these different influences coming in from the cast. How different is the movie, or not different is the movie, from how you might have imagined it when you first came up with the idea?
It's very different for me, I have to say. I mean, we had a really, obviously when we wrote it, we had a really clear idea of how that would look, but we were aware that we had to let that go. Every time we rolled the camera, we had to go to a certain extent.
Although we knew from the get-go what we were going to shoot it on and what the space was going to look like.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of what the characters were, there were elements that were changing on the set. I mean, once the character did something interesting, we're like, oh, actually, that's a really interesting little storyline that we can pull from that, and we can create a slightly different.
Yeah, we were able to be quite reactive with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, particularly towards the end. When we sort of Robbie and Kim left in the bunker, well, in the end of the film, it doesn't matter. Left in the bunker, and they were, some of their performance choices were really fascinating, and we focused on them a little bit more than we maybe did in the script. In a way, it was really positive from our point of view.
I feel like the broad tone of it, though, is probably close to what we.
Yeah, did. Yeah.
And I think what it does is probably pretty close to what we wanted it to do.
Yeah.
But yes, I think there's the other things, because we hadn't written a script, and because we knew it was going to be improvised early doors, we didn't maybe have as clear an idea of exactly what it was going to look like as we would have for other projects we've worked on. So we were already open for it being this other beast and this, you know, something different to what we had envisioned from the get-go. So when it inevitably became something slightly off where we expected it to go, we just embraced that, and it's not a surprise.
Yeah,
I was wondering as well, why did you pick this kind of? Some of your shorts and stuff. The dramas, there's comedies. This is obviously a kind of psychological thriller, maybe in the kind of horror territory. Why did you decide to go in that direction? What was the impetus?
I think going back to the Swanberg thing, the films that he'd made in that kind of period when he had those 11 films that year, they all tend to be sort of relationship dramas.
There's one horror movie.
Yeah. I haven't seen the horror. But we just thought it was more interesting, because I think when you're improvising, everyone's been through broken relationships. I think that's where a lot of these types of films come from, because everyone can sort of relate to that and pull that from within themselves. And we thought it'd be more interesting to move within a sort of genre area with it and see if we can pull out something different from those experiences.
Yes, yeah. We didn't want it to look like all the other mumblecore movies.
Yeah. So we kind of settled on this kind of psychological thriller.
With the veneer of mumblecore.
With the veneer of mumblecore. That kind of slightly red herring element to start off it, that was going to be a kind of standard mumblecore exploration of relationships.
Yeah, it's a dinner party at the beginning, and you're examining the relationships, and then it goes, it left turns.
Yeah, which is something we're kind of fan of in films anyway. Is when you look at something like from Dusk Till Dawn or Audition or something like that, it one way and then swings left.
Yeah, I love when you don't know 20 minutes in where the movie's going to end.
Yeah.
So many movies you do know 20 minutes in exactly kind of where it's going to go.
So that was kind of important to us, and that's more interesting for us as well, you know, although we as you say, we made dramas and comedy and things. It's more interesting in terms of making that feature, in terms of drawing out that tension, that drama, you know, working within a genre like that.
And I also think because we knew we had access, we knew we had access to basically a windowless room, you know, it would be hard for it to be a kind of light romantic drama in a windowless room or a broad comedy. I mean, maybe you could have done the broad comedy. There's another version that's maybe where we could have gone that way. But I think that the room in particular kind of lends itself to that sort of story treatment.
Was there any particular influences that you had in mind when making the film, in terms of like either post-apocalyptic films or other psychological horrors?
Weirdly, the thing that stuck out was probably Threads. Mm-hmm.
A lot of the post-apocalyptic stuff was we were definitely thinking of as we were writing this. I mean, Ribbons is a nod to Threads.
A nod to Threads, yeah.
So yeah, that was pretty big in there, and then yeah, the mumblecore stuff obviously as a less as an aesthetic choice and more as just a kind of means to an end, and then there's other what did we talk about with Rob's character when we were writing it?
Oh, there was one. We can go back. There was a touchstone kit. I don't know. I'm sorry. Sorry. No. My mind just cleared out there. I apologize. There were kind of other elements of
in terms of him being just a really shitty, like horrible guy. There was definitely. I'm also coming out of a blank. Who were we thinking of specifically when we were writing the role? So difficult now because it's been a while, and now I can only.
You can only see Rob.
You can only see Rob in your head in that character, but we were thinking of somebody specific, and I can't remember who it was. Because we did discuss that. I can't remember it. But yeah, I mean, I think we've always thought that your first feature needs to be something that stands out and is unusual and is ballsy. And I think that was definitely the I thought of a lot of the first features of filmmakers that I enjoy. There's risks that you can take when nobody's watching. Almost, I mean, not nobody, but there's risks you can take when it's money that you've raised or just a small amount of money from a studio that, you know, they're not necessarily wanting it back or wanting it to turn into millions of dollars. There's risks you can take and there's experiments you can do with form that you couldn't get further down the line. So I kind of wanted us to not feel restricted in any way and for us really to try and do one of these kind of off the wall, slightly obtuse first features.
Was it, there any challenges or any major differences between filming this feature to what you normally do, so you know, making shorts and making music videos?
In what sense? I mean, different challenges, obviously, because we're telling a bigger story.
Yeah. From a production point of view, it's odd because we've got that really truncated production period. It didn't feel like it was vastly different.
I mean, we probably shot for less money and less time than a lot of people would shoot a short.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we used more footage.
I mean,
definitely did. So weirdly it didn't feel like it was a particularly different process. You know, we were shooting more stuff. There was more of a schedule of things to get through, and we had to have a really clear idea going into each of the sequences. I mean, we would be on set until sort of 1-2 in the morning, making sure we knew the next, like, we've got, mm-hmm. you know, we looked at this and we were,
here's what we missed today,
here's what we need to get tomorrow. Yeah. We were shooting it almost chronologically as well, so that kind of helped.
We had having Chris on set, we had our editor on set who was basically assembling the stuff as we were going.
Yeah.
So by the end of each day, he would say, okay, well, here's day one is complete, here is a rough cut of act one.
Yeah.
Which really helped us to know where we needed to go.
Absolutely.
And also to be, again, reactive if what act one became was something that we hadn't expected, we would be, oh, okay, well, we've got to change day two,
yeah,
so that story continues.
So I guess that's the big difference. If we're shooting a short, then the clarity comes in the creative process at the start, when you're sitting down and you're bored and thing and making sure you know what every single aspect of that film needs to be, whereas with us, the clarity was coming as we went. So mm-hmm. we would film the first day to the set list, to the plans that we had, and then sit down and look at that edit, look at that assembly and go, day two needs to be this.
Yeah.
You know, here's the important piece that we need to get.
A lot of it was like that Wallace and Gromit scene where he's laying the train track in front of him as he's driving.
And within even the set list we had, we color-coded sequences. Mm. So we had like a traffic light system as well. So if we had a was green the important one or the red? No, the red was the important
red
one.
Was the important one. Green, yeah. Was the green. The green were basically, we do one take.
We move on.
Unless somebody falls over, yeah. We're not doing a second take. Yeah. Amber was there. These are quite important, so prepare to spend a little time on them if we need it. But you're not wasting an hour on this shot.
Yeah.
And then the red scenes were the scenes that were really important that we knew we needed to get. Right.
The spine of the narrative.
Yeah,
really,
yeah, yeah, yeah. And we couldn't live without. Some of the green ones, we could lose even. But the red stuff needed to be done well. So we needed to spend a bit of time on. And actually, that really did help for us because we didn't have a first. Although we had Joe helped with a bit of firsting laterally. But yeah. we didn't have somebody on our back saying, you've got to get this. We've got to have this scene by lunch kind of stuff. And actually, that helped us kind of gee ourselves up to get through it.
Yeah.
How did the shoot work, as co-directors, how did the shoot work? Were you doing pretty much everything together, or did Colin take the lead on one thing and you took the lead on another thing, something else, or what's that process?
Weirdly, and we were worried about it before we started, but
we were worried we were going to tear one another apart.
the way I've described for people is that Greg going to something going, I've got the craziest idea in the world, and I'm just wrestling them back into the back to the point where we can do the thing, you know.
And then I'm always enraged that my crazy idea had to be diluted to some degree.
We'll build a platinum elephant, it needs to be a regular elephant and build it with, but actually, so we kind of thought we'd clash a bit more, but actually when we got on set, we kind of dovetailed together pretty well.
I mean, we'd done a lot of prep.
We'd done a lot of prep.
That was half the battle. Yeah. We had conversations about not, you know, we didn't want to have like disagreements in front of the yeah. crew and things like that, which we mostly got.
We mostly agree with. And what we sort of settled on was Greg was also one of the camera operators as well, so he was DPing an element of it.
And I didn't DP any of it. Alan DP.
Alan DP.
But I was operating.
So.
Yeah.
So what we sort of agreed is when we got there is that primarily Greg had worked with the camera stuff. I'd worked with the kind of cast stuff. Although we worked together on the bulk of it. But the idea was that if it came to having to make a call, I would have the final call on cast and end up screaming. Gregor would have the final call on camera. Although I don't think it ever came to that.
No.
It?
I don't think, well, I think
that, was, that was what we talked
I think
about.
I think we envisioned that there might be issues where we would have a disagreement over camera stuff. And
yeah.
Under those circumstances, I said, well, listen, if I'm behind the lens,
yeah,
I'll get the final okay on that. But even that, we didn't really
clash on it. I mean,
and I think we were pretty clear from the beginning that in terms of the acting stuff, we would definitely 50-50.
Absolutely, you know. But I mean, that we didn't. Yeah, like I say, we didn't come to blows, which was excellent.
No.
4 days.
We're both still alive.
We're both still alive. We're both still friends. Although we're in the edit, so we'll see how that goes. we seem to dovetail quite well, and I think again, we were worried that maybe the cast wouldn't have clarity about where direction was coming from, but we continually talked all the way through the process. So when you're going into this conversation with this actor or with this part,
And because the cast had some ownership over that themselves as well. That made that easier.
It was a series of I think, very clear discussions between the cast and ourselves to kind of find out what the next movement was in terms of the film itself.
We also filmed it sequentially, basically. There was a couple of points where we didn't, predominantly sequentially, which I think helps the cast understand, you know, where they are in their arc. They're not having to remember what I was thinking of when I did scene 11, because we've been doing scene 25 all day. You know, I think that, I mean, again, then that was a conscious decision from the start to where possible film it in a linear fashion.
Yeah.
It sounds like the shoot was, given the lengthy hours and the quick turnovers, it sounds like it was surprisingly harmonious both on your side and the cast.
The hours weren't even that lengthy. I mean, we made the call early doors to kind of, you know, shoot like a Woody Allen film, like have everybody get home for their tea, because we didn't want the actors to be exhausted and then have to generate material the next day on 1 hour of sleep. So we I think we did 8 till 6 all 4 days.
No, we pushed it later to this. We pushed it to late, but not that late.
Yeah.
And again, in terms of the actors, in terms of what we were offering them, it's a low budget film. You know, the
producers, everybody got the same rate. So everyone on the set got a flat fee per day they were there. Which again, I think, you know, that kind of communist ideal that, you know, nobody was in a trailer off on their own. Everybody was in it together.
But we did have a trailer.
Everyone was allowed access.
Everyone got the trailer. Again, it goes back to what we said at the start. I mean, we made sure that everyone that was there wanted to be there, and that makes for a harmonious.
We made sure none of them were dicks.
The other thing as well, and this is again maybe an unusual way to do it, is we basically said to the whole cast and crew, look, we're directing this, but you're all here because you are excited about this project. So if you guys have ideas, if we're doing something, you go, actually, that would be great if we did this. Well, listen to that. So I think everyone felt a bit of ownership over it when you have someone, the sound guy can say, do you know what would be cool? And we're listening to that, and we're talking to them and sort of saying that might be a great idea and weaving that into what we're doing.
That's always been a big thing for me as well. The amount of movies you see and you're like, why did like the caterer not say, that's a plot hole? Somebody should have seen that plot hole. And almost certainly somebody did and didn't mention it.
Yeah.
And we wanted people, to engage them and to have everybody be on board, but also to catch stuff that we inevitably would miss.
Some of the best ideas over the weekend shoot came from areas you wouldn't expect. You know, someone who's just like watching this in the monitor going, you know what would be really cool? And sort of saying, yeah, that would be brilliant. That's a cracking idea. That makes a really interesting twist on that character, something that because we're locked in that process between the two of us before we get there. The cast are locked in there. Processes, you know, and when we get there and someone goes, why didn't you have them do that?
Somebody's got fresh eyes.
Yeah. So I think that kind of collective ownership, that idea that we're all building something together. There's a quote I use an awful lot. I can't honestly remember who's attributed to it. There's two ways to build a ship. You either gather men, wood and tools and force them to build a ship, or you gather men and wood and tools and instill in them a deep passionate yearning to be at sea. And I think that's a better way to do things. I think we both do. You know, you want, if you get everyone there and make them passionate about creating that film, then they'll run through walks for you. And at the end of the day, they'll all feel as if it's theirs.
That quote is Shane Ritchie.
He's a wise man.
No one realises he's quite as erudite.
Yeah. You can't see it, but the whole room is covered in Shane Ritchie quotes. Yeah.
It's a very inspirational figure, as Shane Ritchie. That's somewhat thrown the interview, of course.
My apologies.
Yeah, so is there any plans for festival screenings? Or anything of that nature. Have you lined in terms of the release, have you are you going to be going to any festivals, or what's the situation? Is
it, we're gonna aim to. It's still early doors. We don't have a cut we're able to send out yet. So we actually haven't had the conversation about a festival plan. But that is a conversation we'll be having probably over the new year.
The film's 3 hours long at the moment, so we're
It is amazing. The first cut was 2:45, which is absurd, given that means we're shooting basically 45 minutes of material a day. But yes, that first cut was wildly over long. I think if we're 85 minutes in the final version, we'll be very happy.
Yeah.
Nothing over 90 really. Once we have a cut together and we have it scored, there's still a way to go. We would love to have it in as many festivals, and we would love to get local screenings at the very least. We'd love to have it. I mean, from our perspective, the more people that can see it, the better.
Absolutely, and we're really excited. The producers have been brilliant in terms of supporting us, and you know, the social media work that Tartan Features have been phenomenal, you know, in terms of getting excitement, buzz around the film.
The trailer's got loads of views.
Absolutely. You know. X-Films, they're talking about how we kind of create that buzz once the film's finished, and, as well, you know, in terms of getting a premiere and getting exposure to it before it hits festivals. So, I mean, we're genuinely very excited about the plans for it. We're excited for the film. I think it's going to be a good film.
Adam, I'm sure you're deep in post-production. You might not be thinking about this, but you mentioned earlier that you've always got lots of ideas up in the air. Do you have an idea of what your second feature might be? Or is that too early to think of that?
I mean, there's a couple of different things on the board at the moment. You're talking about an entirely one-man film at the moment.
Yes, I've been working on that for a couple of years now, almost.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's another feature done with this same kind of budget level and the same kind of technical setup. Not improvised is what I'm quite keen to do next. But in terms of us directing something together again, we haven't really talked about whether we would necessarily do that next. But we're both open to the idea if the right project comes along.
Yeah,
I think, I mean, to be honest, with this one, the reason that we co-directed was because we felt, given that it was improvised and there were so many plates spinning, having the other, because we came up with the story together. having the other writer on set able to look and see, you've missed that bit, that's a bit we've missed, and being able to kind of combine our two brains to one functional super brain was definitely the approach that worked for this movie. Whether that would necessarily be something we would want to do for other projects where we had a full script, you know, we would have to talk about that.
Well, we've got a couple of kind of written projects together, kind of scripted projects that are slightly out with our budget.
At least one of them wildly out with
one. One of them wildly out with the budget. One of them maybe less so, but we'll see. And we've got a bunch of different kind of projects for different things. So depending how this goes and what doors that opens, you know, potentially, you know, those things can push into production. That'd be fantastic. Yeah. And we'd look at that again. If not, we're both looking at kind of doing low budget things again.
You're looking to do another short this year.
I'm looking to do another short this year.
Beginning of the next year.
In the next year.
I'm quite keen if this were this a success, and you know, by the kind of humble ambitions we have for it, it's not going to be the biggest movie of the year, but it's very unlikely for a movie made for £5,000 to beat Transformers at the box office.
Hey, hi, where's your partner?
But you know, assuming in the worst case scenario that the movie doesn't really go anywhere, it doesn't really make any money, and it doesn't even wipe its face, that I like to think that I would just go back in and do another movie within the same framework, where the worst case scenario is you lose your chunk of the £5,000. And I think we would both agree we still have a lot to learn about how to make movies. We've only done it once. So there's so much value in going back and doing it again with those restrictions in place. Absolutely. But yes, obviously, if this happened to be a kind of meager success, and off the back of that, somebody says, "Well, we love what you did with $5,000. What would you do with $100,000 or $200,000 or $500,000? We would love to have that conversation."
There's this thing. Yeah,
we've got. Yeah. And I mean, we are lucky in that we do have a variety of different projects that could slot into a variety of different production sizes.
Yeah. There's a $100 million Scottish horror film that you would love. It's almost entirely unfilmable at the moment from our point of view.
There's a lot of CGI in it. it's basically Critters, but in Scotland.
Critters in Scotland. That sounds like a great idea for a film.
It really is.
So there's a lovely script sitting here if anyone's interested. Get in touch.
If anyone wants the Scottish Critters, please send us an email. We will sell you that script, or you can give us money to make it.
Just tweet Blumhouse or something. I'm sure they'll give you $10 million. Yeah. You know,
he tosses cash at everyone, that guy.
Do you think our German buddy would help us out?
You think Uwe Boll would give us more?
Uwe
Boll's retired now.
Oh, is he? just to explain. We'll do an anecdote.
Okay. We're going to attempt to get him involved in this.
We are. Hopefully,
he hasn't replied to my email, but.
Yeah.
I'll chase him up.
A few years ago, we tried to make a sci fi film, and we kind of approached a number of kind of producers. It was another thing that was slightly more expensive than what we could do on our own. And we approached a couple of different guys. About back in the film, and Uwe Boll got in touch.
Did we not meet his producer in Cannes?
We met his producer in Cannes, and then he flew us out to.
He didn't fly us out. We paid for those tickets.
We flew. We walked his dogs.
He invited us to Frankfurt.
Frankfurt.
Thank you. To come and discuss the movie because he was at that point looking to buy low budget, to distribute low budget features through some kind of German legal loophole,
and.
I think he was very nice.
He was absolutely lovely. We went and walked these enormous stations around the park in Frankfurt. And he outlined the most bananas way to fund the film that I've ever... It was, you know, the guys... Whatever you think of Uwe Boll's films, the guys get balls. You know, I mean, he really does. And in terms of the way he was saying, this is how you make your film. Had we not delivered that film, we would have lost everything for generations to come.
Our families would have been destitute for many, many years. the back end of that was that I like to think it would be fun to get him. We've got a couple of voiceover parts that need to be. There's basically voices on a radio that they hear.
Yeah,
we would love to get Uwe Boll to do one of those voices. In his native tongue as well.
The
British audience would not know what he was saying necessarily unless they had good German, and he would be able to basically say whatever he liked at that point in the film.
That would be hilarious. I mean Uwe Boll's films are terrible, but I mean he is quite amazing in terms of how he gets funding for everything.
He's a brilliant producer, and even at the point where we went over to see him, and he's proudly shown us around a really lovely production facility he's got set up over there.
He had, I don't think he's got. Mm-hmm. He's retired from film.
And he's, well, yeah, it's true. Mm-hmm. I mean, at that point, he was editing something with like Jason Statham and Burt Reynolds in it. I mean, the guy.
The Ron Perlman one, the kind of sword and source.
Dungeon Quest. It's based in Dungeon Quest. It's like based in an old Neo Geo game or something.
What was it called?
I think it was called In the Name of the King, the one with Jason Statham.
Kind of fantasy thing.
So the guy's a brilliant producer, was a brilliant producer. Just that.
And he was a very nice guy.
Lovely guy, yeah.
But yeah, that's our one anecdote.
That's our one anecdote. We hope you enjoyed it, folks.
Yeah, they tuned in to listen about your movie Ribbons, and then we get inspirational Shane Ritchie quotes and Uwe Boll anecdotes. That's
walking
dogs
with Uwe Boll.
What more could you want from an episode of a podcast? Well, I honestly don't think we're gonna top that. So I think we'll leave it there. We'll call it a wrap. It's been great to have you both on the show, and
thank you.
I wish you all the best with Ribbons. The trailer looks really good. I've seen a lot of positive things of it. It seems to be getting a lot of traction, so I wish you all the best success.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
That was my guests, Gregor Barclay and Colin Bell there, who, as you can tell, I had great fun chatting to. I'd like to thank them once again for coming on the show and telling us all about their film Ribbons, which I very much look forward to seeing when it is released. And as always, I'd like to thank you for tuning in to this latest episode of the show. That's pretty much it. But as always, you can check out all previous episodes of the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get good podcasts from. Remember, you can also rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher, or follow us on Spotify. You can also give us a like on Facebook, follow us on Twitter for all your latest New Horror Express news. Don't forget to tune in 2 weeks' time for our next show, where I will be chatting to indie horror author J.P. Willey. Anyway, that's all for now. See you next time.